Good afternoon. Our third case is for today is 11-18-24-24. And we have two cases that have been consolidated for appeal, and for purposes of the oral argument, counsel asked that give extra time and that they be argued somewhat separately because the issues are in part somewhat different. So one is 11-18-24-24 State versus Nancy Pino. The other is 12-18-9-18 State v. Travis Seaton. And is there a preference as to which case be called first? You know? First. Okay, that's fine. 11-18-24-24, State v. Pino. And this will be the lineup as I have it. 18 minutes, Leonard Kaczynski is going to argue on behalf of the defendant, Nancy Pino. 22.5 minutes, Gregory Weber, Assistant Attorney General, State of Wisconsin. 4.5 minutes, Kaczynski rebuttal. We will then have the second third case, 12-18-9-18, State v. Travis Seaton, 18 minutes, Amelia Bizarro, representing Travis Seaton, 22.5 minutes, Daniel J. O'Brien, representing the State of Wisconsin, and 4.5 minutes, Amelia Bizarro, on rebuttal. Okay. And I see that the lineup is the state is on one side of the podium and the defense counsel are on the other side. The court got, just so we are all on the same page, today from Mr. Weber a copy of the Court of Appeals decision dated and filed September 4th. That's today, in the case of State of Wisconsin versus Amos Small. Did you send a copy to the defendant's counsel?
I spoke to Amelia this morning and spoke to
them. Okay. They have access to this. All right. I did distribute this to the court. So I think all the details before we get into the substance of these cases have now been taken care of. So I will call on Leonard Kaczynski to argue on behalf of Ms. Pino. Mr. Kaczynski. Not related to anyone we heard about this morning. Go ahead.
Correct, Your Honor. You know, may it please the court, this case against Ms. Pino started in January 2009 when her son, Brandon Mueller, murdered a Renee Redmer at Ms. Pino's apartment in Fond du Lac. Ms. Pino was accused of assisting Mr. Mueller in taking the body of Ms. Redmer to an area of rural Fond du Lac County with an accomplice named Mr. Worth. It is alleged that Ms. Pino assisted in the transportation of individuals to the spot where the body of Ms. Redmer was burned and also provided transportation to the same individuals after they took the body to Lake Winnebago and distributed the ashes. She's also was charged not only with mutilation of a corpse, party to a crime, but also charged with obstructing for giving false statements to the police on approximately four different occasions. She was charged in July of 2009, and she had a trial in December of 2009. The trial lasted approximately 5 days. But the first day of the trial, they called in a large number of jurors. I believe the record indicates 85, 83 of which showed up, a number of which taxed the facilities of the courtroom where Judge Richard Nuss was conducting this trial. Judge Nuss, prior to jury selection on his own, told the parties that he wanted everyone except prospective jurors out of the courtroom. He didn't want any press there. And no one said anything. No one objected. They took a recess. The trial then resumed in terms of the voir dire of the jury. The judge said, was there anything else to be raised before they continue with jury selection? Nobody said anything. And then the jury selection was conducted for 2 hours and 9 minutes.
Was everyone cleared out of the courtroom except the jurors, or wasn't the courtroom cleared?
There's no evidence in the record that deputies or anyone else physically cleared the courtroom. It was an order from the judge to everyone who was present. The record doesn't indicate.
Does the record indicate people left? That there were people in the courtroom when the judge made that order and that they walked out, or the record just silent about what actually happened?
The testimony from Pinnell's trial attorney was that Pinnell's relatives had been present before, that the trial, when it resumed, she didn't look back to see if they were still in the courtroom after all the jurors had gone into the courtroom where Judge Nuss was conducting the jury selection. So she did not know, and we didn't have any evidence that we were able to present on that issue either in this particular case.
In the other case, there were apparently officers stationed outside the door to prevent people from coming in. Was that true here?
That, I think, also the record in this case was unclear. I believe the testimony of the jury clerk at the post-conviction motion hearing indicated that there were officers there, although she indicated that some persons whose identity was unknown had gone in and out of the courtroom anyway. So that was unclear as well, unlike the Pinnell case, or excuse me, unlike the Seton case. The issues in the case, first of all, was the jury selection closed to the public? It's our position that based on the record where Judge Nuss ordered them out, ordered the press out, that alone is sufficient to establish that it was a closed courtroom. We particularly remind the justices of the cases that were cited in our reply brief, the Nong case, N-J, O-E-N-G, from the state of Washington, the Vaughn case from the state of Michigan, the Stackhouse case from Colorado, where judges there assumed that with a judicial order, there's a presumption of regularity, the presumption that individuals are going to follow it, and a presumption that if there was any blatant violation, that the presiding judge noted that the judge undoubtedly would have done something about it. But we don't have anything on the record to establish that for sure. It's simply a presumption.
And you, you said that people were ordered out. Who was ordered out? Who was out that previously was in?
Basically, the order was anybody who, there other than.
I
but
know what
we
the
don't
order
know.
Was. But the record does not say anything as to someone being denied the right to be in the courtroom.
No.
Someone having to leave the courtroom.
We're unable to identify any specific person other than from the testimony of the trial attorney, which was not terribly definite on that issue. Correct.
Fair enough. That's what I thought you said. And then when you said people were ordered out, I thought maybe I heard you wrong. So that's why.
So all you really have firm is that the trial court judge said only the jurors should be in. Is that, that's really the only firm thing you have. Then you're trying to say that the presumption is that people followed the orders and that the jury clerk followed the orders and the officers and bailiff, if anyone were there, followed it, but you, there's not really strong, conclusive evidence that that's true.
Correct. That's the best we were able to come up with at the time of the post-conviction motion hearing.
And what did the judge say on the post-conviction motion?
Well, the judge, on his own motion, essentially, called the jury clerk, Ms. Petrie, to testify. And Ms. Petrie wasn't there when the order was issued, was there when the jurors were brought in from an assembly area into the courtroom. And she testified that jurors, or at least some persons, were seen coming in and out. The jurors pretty much filled the courtroom. And I think her testimony as to the presence of sheriff deputies was pretty inconclusive.
Did judge say, well, I never really intended and never executed the order that there should only be jurors?
That's what Judge Nuss attempted to say, yes.
Pardon me?
That's what Judge Nuss attempted to say at the post-conviction motion hearing.
Well, that's what I'm asking you. I want to know what his position is. His position is he never closed this.
Correct. His definition of a closed courtroom is where it's barred, much like happens sometimes in juvenile proceedings and not simply a judicial order. The second issue was the violation if it occurred more than de minimis, because there are cases that suggest if it's a very short period of time, it may not really violate speedy trial to the extent that there be structural error and automatic reversal. It was 2 hours and 9 minutes, and there is also the Presley versus Georgia, where the U.S. Supreme Court has told us that jury selection is a critical part of the proceedings to which the right to a public trial applies. So I think clearly the amount of time and the nature of the proceedings are sufficient that if it occurred, as we say it occurred, that there was a closed trial, that there would be a violation of the right to a public trial. The issue which is even more interesting is whether or not it was structural error justifying automatic reversal. Well, this court in the Ford case, paragraph 43, listed this sort of violation, that is the violation of a right to a public trial as an automatic reversal and being structural, as being at least structural error. So I think it's...
That goes to prejudicial error?
Correct.
So what are your three issues? Was it actually closed?
Correct.
That's one. Number two, did this really implicate the Sixth Amendment?
Right.
That was a de minimis. It really didn't implicate the Sixth Amendment. And three, assuming it was closed and it did implicate the Sixth Amendment, it's automatically prejudicial, or viewed as prejudicial because of structural error. That's the three issues.
So far.
Okay.
Yeah, I would think there is another issue, is there not?
Go ahead.
You get into a question of remedy. And let's assume that there was closure, that the Sixth Amendment is involved. Let's assume that there was no forfeiture or waiver. You've indicated there was no objection here. What remedy do you think is called for, assuming those things?
I think based on the facts of this case and the nature of the closure, I think the evidence from decisions by courts throughout the country is almost always a new trial. Not a question of going back, for example, and trying to justify the closure under the Waller versus Georgia criteria.
Also, I would put to you that the Supreme Court has said something very different, particularly in Waller versus Georgia, where it was the closure of a suppression hearing that was held to be a violation of the public trial's right. And the court said, no, the remedy is not a new trial. The remedy is a new suppression hearing. And only if the rights of the parties change after that suppression hearing is a new trial warranted. So I'm not sure that you can just say the remedy is always a new trial.
Talking of a suppression hearing, I think you have a good point, Justice. But I think in this case where you've got it's jury selection, there's really no way to go back and say you have something different with a selection of a different jury.
Well, you know, what I interpret, I think it was Justice Powell who was speaking in the part that I was looking at, is he was looking at prejudice. Was a prejudice to the defendant's right and the rights that arise out of a public trial. And so that's why he got to the remedy. And, you know, assuming the facts, as Justice Cook gave them to you, I think remedy is a significant issue in this case as well. I'm not persuaded that you automatically get a new trial. And when I read everything that's in the U.S. Supreme Court cases on this, it seems to me they almost look at whether there was prejudice to those values that an open trial was supposed to create. So, you know, I'm not sure that maybe a remand with an opportunity to argue why you think your client's rights was prejudiced
and then a determination at that point isn't a sufficient remedy. Why do you think it's not a sufficient remedy?
Well, in a sense, we've already had that in the post-conviction motion hearing, and I can assure the court we searched for persons that had a good, reliable recollection of those proceedings. Now, you know, we're a different situation than the Setons. The Setons were paying for their own defense of their son and paid a lot more attention than Ms. Pinnell's relatives, who were less sophisticated and had less of a direct interest financially or knowledge of the system than the Setons did. So that's part of the reason why we are in that situation here.
Okay. Well, you can see why they might order a suppression hearing and have it open. And you can redo that. You can't redo this trial. I mean, you can't redo voir dire. What do? Bring in a whole new panel and then have a fake mock trial to see if a different jury that was selected openly reaches a different result. I mean, that is a very cumbersome. It is, in effect, a new trial.
It would be. And I think that's, for example, in the Vanessa case, the Court of Appeals didn't try to redo the last 2 hours of the Vanessa trial when they found out it was inadvertently closed because of a courthouse policy. They gave Vanessa a whole new trial. And I think they have to do the same in this case. It's not the same as where you've got a suppression hearing and perhaps there might be a different result.
Justice Crooks's discussion of another issue is remedy, which was very good, subsumed another issue, which you probably wouldn't get to, whether or not by the failing to object was a forfeiture or a waiver or neither or both.
Right. That was the next on the list, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you have another?
No, that's it.
Okay. All right. You can
well,
talk
I think
about
that's,
forfeiture.
That's an important issue in this case. Whether the leading case on that was Walton versus Briley, where there was no objection. Or either for that case in the Dyna. But I think in this case, what Judge Nuss, having acted on his own, while it's true, as the state has said, that the trial attorney did not have her tongue tied when they came back into session, which you might have given some thought to it, but I think that given the fact it was sui sponte and done in the situation, that you really should not invoke forfeiture. Now, had it been different, like, for example, in Amos Small's case, where Judge Simple had given the parties ample opportunity for evidentiary hearing and discussion and everything else, and the attorney there didn't decide they want the hearing, perhaps because they thought they might lose, I don't know. But I think in that case, you could say that forfeiture might be justified. But in this one, where it's a sua sponte action by the court, with no warning whatsoever or real opportunity to object in terms of the court inviting objections like Judge Simple did in the Small case, I think clearly you should not invoke forfeiture. I think the only way really to vindicate the rights to a public trial when there are violations is to find that there is error, especially when it's substantial, like in this case, when there's no way of undoing it, and to find that it has to have a deliberate waiver from a defendant before it's considered to be waived. I mean, this isn't a situation where we sat around or where Pinnell's counsel sat around trying to invite the court to commit some sort of error. This was almost, I think, a surprise.
Mr. Kaczynski, this is the kind of case where, based on my experience on the trial bench, I would expect that there would be a rather great media interest. Was there anyone there from the media who was objecting to the order of the judge, saying that they couldn't be there?
From my understanding, there were no members of the media present. The record doesn't reflect that there were any. I have had some off-the-record conversations with the local reporter yesterday, I think, from Fond du Lac as to whether he was there or not. There's a radio station there that covers most trials. They don't find much interest in jury selection. But I think in terms of the public interest anyway, you've got to certainly have the relatives of the defendant and his friends, any of those who wanted to watch where the public interest is still important to have during the jury selection process.
Well, one of the reasons I assume Justice Crooks asked that question is because the amicus brief raises the other issue of the fact that although there's a Sixth Amendment right to the defendant, there is or may be a First Amendment right for the public, including the media, to be present. And the citation in the amicus brief is to the La Crosse case. And that was not raised in this case, at least in these briefs. So what is your comment on the amicus brief and the whole First Amendment, and how does it fit in with your argument?
Well, you know, Ms. Pinto doesn't have the standing that the media has to raise the issue, but I think as a practical matter, as the courts have noted, the only practical way to enforce the media's right would be, in most cases, for it to be raised on appeal by a defendant who is prejudiced by the outcome of the trial. So I'd agree that there is a First Amendment issue here. It's just not one that anyone was in a position to raise at the time, and that Ms. Pinto really doesn't have direct standing to raise a First Amendment issue since she's not a member of the media.
Yeah, but there's a statute that says, I mean, that under WSSTAT 757.14, the sittings of every court shall be public. This is Wisconsin. And every citizen may freely attend the same. Whose obligation is it to see that the court shall be public, the city shall be public? Isn't it the judge's obligation to make sure that the statute is complied with, since the judge has control over the courtroom?
Absolutely. That's exactly the...
If this was closed to the public by judge order, did the judge violate the statute?
I'm afraid he did. Unless he had the... I guess with the exception if he met the criteria in Waller versus Georgia, which in this case clearly wasn't met.
But you can close the courtroom.
Oh, absolutely.
The judge can close it if the judge makes an appropriate record that closing was required in order to run that court and in order to get an effective, efficient, fair proceeding. Right?
Correct. Or to prevent intimidation of witnesses like
yeah.
in the small case.
I mean,
exactly.
But that fits within my criteria. Or it shouldn't be my criteria. It's the Waller and other court case criteria. And the one that was discussed in the small case, because there the judge had a reason. You may accept it or not, but there was a reason. And the reason went to the trial. Here the reason went, there is no room. Well, how many, do you know if there's a pattern in Fond du Lac County? Because here we have two cases. Two cases don't make a pattern, but they might make other acts evidence that this was a criminal trial. So what about that?
I haven't had enough cases in Fond du Lac to really give you an answer to that, but it was seemed the judge seemed quite comfortable in making this decision both in Seton and in our case. So I think it's something he felt he could do, and he didn't really give any thought to some of the less restrictive alternatives that were available to prevent jury contamination, provide adequate room for the jurors, places for spectators, and so forth. There's other big trials where there's been special spaces outside the courtroom for spectators.
But this is what I was going to say. We've had cases where you might have more than the courtroom, and you can't build courtrooms so that for the one time, two times a year, where you have 100 people in there or more. But you do make accommodations so that the courtroom remains open by loudspeakers and by closed circuit TV, etc.
Correct. And when I talked to a reporter from a radio station yesterday, he told me about that, and I sort of thought that was the case. And I've seen it in other counties where they've done that.
Does it make any difference that the Presley case was decided after this trial was over?
I don't think it would make a difference as to whether, because Presley was based on a series of cases. It wasn't any surprise that the jury selection process would be considered a part of the trial, and that violation of that would be structural error. So I don't think it really makes any difference. It's not a surprise the case was that caused this court to consider that issue, for example, in Dearborn.
Counselor, when I hear the word structural error, I have to tell you it raises the hair on the back of my neck a little bit, because I think it has, at least in my knowledge, a very narrow application, and it's a type of error where, when it occurs, the defendant cannot get a fair trial. It would occur if you had a biased judge that made up his mind or her mind before the trial. It would occur if there was denial of a right to counsel. But I'm not so sure that this kind of an error in voir dire is the kind of an error that you can automatically then take the next step and say the defendant could not have had a fair trial. You want to address that for me?
Well, whether or not the result of the trial in this case would have been different had this occurred is not something anyone's ever going to be able to...
Not the result as much as a fair trial. Fair trial.
The problem is we just, for this sort of thing, we just don't know. I think it's, our position is it's such an important constitutional right both to Ms. Pinto and to the public that in order to effectuate strict enforcement of that right that we need to have automatic structural error and automatic reversal.
Saying it's structural error, in my mind, is also inconsistent with Waller, which says you can close it if you do A, B, and C, right?
Correct.
So if it were something that you can't do, and if you do it, the defendant doesn't get a fair trial, you wouldn't have Waller standing there looking at us, right? Because you would say you can't close it. There can't be a reason sufficient. The defendant's interest as an interest in right to counsel always supersede. But they don't always supersede other interests that can be raised in regard to whether the trial is public or not.
I'd agree. It's not an absolute right. No. There's the limitations that you can put on there for circumstances to ensure a fair trial, such as the Waller criteria, such as was done in the Small case. But I think, especially under the facts of this case, where you've got this type of situation as opposed to that in Nadina, that really you have to call it structural error and give Ms. Pinto a new trial.
Thank you.
Well, you don't. What you have to say is that there'll be no remedy for violation of a Sixth Amendment and First Amendment right, because it's almost impossible to prove that you didn't get a fair trial just because the doors were closed. You don't know what would happen if someone was sitting there and would know that a juror should have answered a question but didn't, or that there's some information that should be passed to the defendant because of their knowledge, the witness, not a witness, but somebody in the courtroom would have knowledge. It would be almost impossible to ever prove that. So unless you give a new trial where the issue is at open or closed at a trial. Too bad, so sad.
Pretty much, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. All right. Gregory M. Weber, State of Wisconsin Assistant Attorney General representing the state. Mr. Weber.
Chief Justice, members of the court, good afternoon. The state asks this court to write a powerful opinion that stresses five critical points. The first point, reviewing courts should analyze a defendant's failure to object to the closure of a public trial under the forfeiture doctrine. The second point, by failing to object at the time of the alleged violation, in this case, Pinto forfeited her ability to assert a violation of that right on appeal. Third, the public trial right does not require a defendant's personal informed waiver. Fourth, a reviewing court may consider a forfeited claim in the context of ineffective assistance of counsel. Fifth, and perhaps most important for outcome in this case, Pinto has absolutely failed to prove ineffective assistance of counsel.
On which, on in your last point, on which prong?
Both. Mm-hmm. No deficient performance, no actual prejudice. And in fact, Chief, your question at the beginning of Ms. Pinnow's argument really cements the prejudice analysis here. You asked counsel if the courtroom was cleared. And the answer is we don't know. We absolutely don't know. We have a finding from the circuit court that there was no closure. The significance of that finding is that the defendant can't prove ineffective assistance of counsel, can't prove deficient performance.
How come he makes an order that says clear the courtroom and then says at a further hearing the trial court says, well, that wasn't the order. It wasn't. Was it? What did he say? That he never issued that order, the order didn't say that, or that it wasn't put into effect? What was the trial
court's view? He plainly made the comments. We don't know on this record, apart from the judge's finding in the post-conviction proceedings, that the courtroom was not closed. The only independent evidence we have is testimony that was taken at the post-conviction motion hearing that indicated that people were leaving and entering the courtroom. We also, if you dig a bit, mine a bit in the record in this case, record 130 is the transcript of the trial. It contains the analysis of sequester of the voir dire. If you look at page 7 of record 130, you see trial counsel saying that there were two friends of Nancy Pinnow's in the courtroom. By the court, they will be excused during the voir dire. By Pinnow's counsel, understood. Now, we don't know. We don't know if those two people left the courtroom. But is there any doubt, really, that if they had been forced, Pinnow's friends, if they had been forced to leave the courtroom, why didn't we have affidavits at a post-conviction motion hearing?
Okay.
Well, why don't we have affidavits? Why didn't Pinnow call these two people to testify to the fact that they were excluded from the courtroom?
Counsel, how about rather than these five powerful points that you want us to make, it doesn't seem that you get to first base, assuming your arguments are correct and your statements are correct, it doesn't seem that you even get to first base if there is a failure to show that the courtroom is closed. Why would we tackle those other issues if your argument is correct, without that underlying necessary condition?
If you conclude that the courtroom was not closed, the state wins in Pinnow. Well, and you don't have to go to the other issues.
We don't conclude things. I mean, the question is whether or not the defendant, I suppose, sustained the burden of showing that the courtroom was closed. Right?
Yes, and
I don't know if it was. I don't know if it wasn't. I wasn't there.
Right.
But we deal with burdens of proof and evidence, and what evidence do we have, and did the evidence that was presented sustain the burden of showing, I think.
At the beginning of this case, we have unpreserved error, and that's where the state began its analysis in this case.
Who presided at the post-conviction hearing?
I thought Judge Nuss did.
So Judge Nuss is the presiding judge, and Judge Nuss is also determines what he said, what he intended, and decides whether it was or wasn't closed. Is there a problem here?
We asked circuit judges to explain what their reasoning was and why they did what they did and what happened in the courtroom all the time in a number of different situations.
Not in writing. Do they do it as a witness? I mean, I've seen cases where the judge appears as a witness.
No, never asked for substitution and permission to call the judge as a witness. Okay. Not in my case, at least. Not in mm-hmm. Pinnow.
All right.
There's a point that I want to come back to in the context of our discussions of structural error. Structural error in this context only has constitutional significance if the defense counsel had objected to the closure. And this is a point we make at several points in the state's brief in Pinno. The constitutional significance of structural error is connected to an objection. And Waller even speaks in terms of preserved, objected to violations or alleged violations of the public trial right. If you don't have that objection, the fact that the public trial right may be structural doesn't preclude the state from contending that they have to show ineffective assistance of counsel. That in the context of a forfeited structural error argument, you have to go the ineffective assistance of counsel route. And this court has made that clear in a number of different contexts.
You would have the same problem, though, that I identified for opposing counsel. Anytime you raise ineffective assistance on this kind of a claimed error, because how are you going to prove prejudice? I mean, that was his objection to my suggestion that there should be a different remedy, even if I bought all the arguments he was selling. How are you going to prove it?
It's not an easy task to prove prejudice in this context, but it shouldn't be. Look at the extremes that you're being asked to consider.
It may not be easy, but it shouldn't be impossible. I mean, I got from his comment when I questioned him about that he didn't think there was a way you could go about doing it. And I guess I put it to you. If it's ineffective assistance of counsel, it's tough, but how do you do it?
If somebody were excluded from the courtroom who could have contributed something during the voir dire process that would have assisted the defense, a defendant can certainly talk to individuals that he or she knew were in the courtroom. Were you actually put out? Yes. Could you have done something? Here's a list of the candidates for voir dire. Do you know any of those people? Why, yes, I know John Doe.
But the observers in the courtroom don't get to comment on that.
They do if they're asked in an investigation by post-conviction counsel. It's not an easy process. I don't deny that for a minute. But consider it against the alternative. Automatic reversal for any kind of public trial violation?
Well, I was looking for another remedy because I think the U.S. Supreme Court clearly indicated that it doesn't have to be a new trial. Now, there they were looking at a suppression hearing. I think counsel's point to me is well taken. This is quite a different part of the trial.
But you're also looking at preserved error in that context, Justice Rogan-Sack. In each of those, there was an objection. The absence of objection has to have some impact in the case. The impact is that you can still press your public trial objection, but you have to do it in the context of ineffective assistance. You have to show deficient performance and actual prejudice. And Ms. Pinno can't do either of them. She cannot do either of them here.
If it is preserved error and it is structural, then I understood the law to be that prejudice is just automatically assumed. That's what structural error is.
Right. That's the way I interpret it, too, Justice Breyer.
Nadina, the majority in Nadina, gave us an analytical framework that we're supposed to follow. The Nadina framework basically sets, at paragraph 56, sets a two-step test. And the first question is, assuming there's a closure, does the closure at issue implicate the Sixth Amendment public trial right? And the position we took in that litigation is you have the four core values that are served by the public trial right. Ensure a fair trial, impress upon the prosecutor and the judge their responsibilities, encourage witnesses to come forward, and discourage perjury. That's kind of the first step in the process. If the closure does implicate the Sixth Amendment public trial right, then we're supposed to determine whether the closure was justified under the facts and circumstances of the case. And in Nadina, this court used the four Waller standards. You could certainly...
And Nadina, though, clearly implicated the Sixth Amendment.
I believe the court held that.
Yeah, the court... the court clearly held that it clearly implicated. It may clearly not have been your opinion, however.
And going back to Justice Rogan-Sack's point, in both of our briefs, in Pinno and in Seaton, the state has taken the position that the core values of the public trial right, the four core values, were not violated in either of these cases. They certainly weren't violated in Pinno. But I agree, the Waller and a number of other cases have said that remedy has to fit the nature of the wrong, of the violation. But all of those cases talk about preserved error, and that's really an important point here. It takes us out of the framework of the Sixth Amendment structural error context and puts us in the context of ineffective assistance.
Mr. Weber, what do you mean by core values? What core values are you talking about that weren't offended if this activity actually took place and there was not forfeiture or waiver? What core values are we talking about?
The most detailed analysis of that in Pinno appears at pages 34 to 36 of our brief, the state's brief in Pinno. The core values are derived from the United States Supreme Court cases, Waller and some of the other cases, the First Amendment cases, that say that the Sixth Amendment public trial right, in our context, the Sixth Amendment public trial right is designed to vindicate four core values, and the first is to ensure a fair trial. In Pinno, there's no question that Pinno received a fair trial. We have the transcripts. We have the record to prove it. There's no claim of any other kind of error in this case in Pinno except for that alleged Sixth Amendment violation. The second core value, to remind the prosecutor and the circuit court of their responsibility both to the accused and the public and the importance of that function. You have to remember that in Pinno, we had a courtroom that had defense attorneys in it, court officers, between 80 and 85 prospective jurors. This was not a situation where somebody threw a padlock on the court and put guards outside and said, no, you can't come in here. The courtroom was full of people. There's no indication in this case. The third core value is to encourage witnesses to come forward. There's nothing in the way that the circuit court conducted its jury selection in this case that suggests anyone was discouraged from coming forward. There's no indication that the jury selection in this case did anything that wouldn't discourage perjury. Those fundamental core values were all vindicated in this case.
Well, let me just ask you this. Let's suppose that, a lot of times the defendant really doesn't want an open courtroom, wants as little publicity as possible, in part maybe because he thinks a little less publicity on the heinous nature of the crime will help out in sentencing. I mean, there may be any number of reasons. And so, and the state may or may not be interested in whether if it's open or closed, and they agree, hey, closed is fine with them. And the judge closes it. So there are no values, there's forfeiture, not only forfeiture, waiver, consent, request. I mean, you can fill in whatever you want. And that courtroom is closed. And we're not going to have a debate on whether it's closed or not. It is closed. Think that's okay under the Sixth Amendment? Because I'm setting you up, obviously.
Of course.
To ask you about the other issue of the First Amendment, which is not briefed, but which I think it was in your one of the briefs here.
A footnote in page one in my
book. Yes, exactly. That says, hey, you don't object to that discussion. And then it came in, which you might have suspected would, in an amicus brief. So I, from my perspective, looking at this, you may or may not have a Sixth Amendment issue under the fact situations I gave you, but you've got a real issue under the First Amendment, and from my perspective, you have a real issue under a statute. The jury selection is a pretrial proceeding. I don't think anyone's talking about, objecting to that. 757.14 says, the sittings shall be public. Every citizen may freely attend the same. I don't think there's any question, but the person, the institution that is responsible for whether the sitting is open or closed is the trial court and the trial court judge. Do you agree with that? Who else has?
I have a number of responses. Let's hope I can get through all of them.
Okay, let me give you my bottom line on that. We have a case under 805.18 in which the court said, and in this one the statute is 805.18.1, the court shall in every stage of an action disregard any error or defect which shall not affect the substantial rights. The reason I cite that is because, of course, the court said it doesn't matter whether anybody raises the issue of prejudice or harmless error. It's the court's obligation under that statute to raise the issue itself. And I suggest that it's the court's obligation under 757.14 to raise the issue on public, whether or not, and reach that issue and make its findings, whether or not the defendant makes any objection.
My first response, and you might guess at that as well, is that the state would consider it a travesty if this defendant received a new trial based on a First Amendment right that he had no standing to assert.
That's right. We're not debating that. He relies on the Sixth Amendment. But there is a First Amendment here, and the person that has that First Amendment right is the public and represented by the media, or you could say the media and the public, and they're not there, so that the court can be closed on agreement of the parties and too bad for the public.
The state would welcome a decision by this court, a powerful, forceful decision, reminding judges of their obligations to the First Amendment and the First Amendment public trial right. The state certainly wouldn't object to that.
But you don't want us to enforce it.
I don't want you to enforce it by giving this defendant a new trial. No, absolutely not.
Well, what about new trials hereafter when all the judges are advised they have an obligation?
I would not.
I mean, let's be powerful. Let's not be a wimp.
No, let's not be a wimp, but let's not extend benefits to a criminal defendant who had error-free trial, Chief, an error-free trial.
I'm not even going to debate that. I give it to you. But you got a basic problem here, a violation of a statute and a constitutional right of the entire public. Because, unlike in the Sixth Amendment, the value in a public trial is to the public, that the public can see that the courts are operating according to the law and facts. It is the public's right to regulate the courts and complain if they're not functioning well.
And as we pointed out in our brief, there were over 80 people that were in that courtroom that could testify to excesses that worked to the defendant's disadvantage or to the state's advantage.
The argument could be made that it was public because you had the jury, but of course it was a select public forced there by subpoena of the court, not people that were otherwise there. But that, you know,
they were citizens as well, Chief, who have an obligation or an interest in making sure that the proceedings were fair.
Sure.
There's one point I want to make, and I'm going to go into the red very quickly.
I issued a press release saying that's the whole point of the jury, to watch the courts.
In the context of a Sixth Amendment violation based on Bourdieu, certainly the veneerman can represent the public in that regard. You talked about the First Amendment protecting the rights beyond the defendant.
Right.
In Batson versus Kentucky, courts have held that a defendant's right to have a racially or gender mixed jury also vindicates the public's right, also vindicates the rights of prospective jurors to appear as prospective jurors. And Batson claims can be waived. Batson claims can be forfeited. The case you want to look at is...
You don't have a statute, McGavin, the 757-14, imposing an obligation on the court.
As I said before, the First Amendment rights or the First Amendment issues here, this court can write a decision that reminds judges that they have a statutory obligation. Certainly Ms. Pinnow has not raised a statutory violation claim, nor has she raised a state constitutional violation claim. I want to come back to the last point that I made. The fact that a constitutional right benefits not only the defendant but also the public, as in Batson, doesn't make that right immune from forfeiture. There's a case called United States versus Heron, H-E-R-O-N, 721 F3rd, 896. It's a Seventh Circuit decision from this year that talks about Batson rights being subject to forfeiture. In State versus Flynn, 190 with second 31, our Court of Appeals also noted that Batson rights were subject to forfeiture. Batson is a right that benefits, may I finish my thought?
No, go ahead, I'm sorry. Yes.
That benefits not only the defendant, but also the public. That doesn't mean it isn't subject to forfeiture.
Didn't the Seventh Circuit, we have too many cases today which have similar kind of forfeiture issues.
I know the field.
Didn't the Seventh Circuit say that there's no forfeiture here of open court? Right, they got the wrong. Didn't the Seventh Circuit have a case that you had to, that you don't have forfeiture when there's no objection made when there's a closing of the courts?
We cited, I'm blanking on the name, there are too many cases. We did cite a Seventh Circuit opinion in support of our position in Pinnow.
I thought there was a Seventh Circuit case in support of the defendant's position, but we can check that out.
I'm sure Mr. Kaczynski will give us.
Pardon me?
I'm sure Mr. Kaczynski will give us that.
All right. Good.
I thank the court.
I thank you, and I appreciate your thought on the First Amendment and whether or not it's analogous to Batson. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief.
Let's see. Who do we have up next?
Mr. Kaczynski. All right.
Mr. Kaczynski. You've got 4.5 minutes in rebuttal.
Well, this is not a case such as the one that was cited in the Law Review article sent to the court by Assistant Attorney General O'Brien, where there was a in-chambers conference regarding a jury that nobody really objected to. It was a very short period of time, and the Washington State Court of Appeals decided that wasn't enough to give Mr. Sublett a new trial. This is one where you've got 2 hours and 9 minutes closed to the public by judicial order, and I think that the judicial order under all the facts of this case would be sufficient for most individuals to say, and other courts and other jurisdictions to say, that in fact it was a closed courtroom. I think that there was, as the Chief Justice has been suggesting, a violation of 957-14, and there's an implicit constitutional exception to that under the criteria of Waller versus Georgia. But again, there was no reasoning process at all on the record for what Judge Nuss did until after the fact when he did the post-conviction motion hearing. There was a Seventh Circuit case that did support the position of Ms. Pinnow. It would be Walton versus Briley, B-R-I-L-E-Y, 361, Fed 3rd, 431, 2004. I believe that was cited by both of the parties in their brief. So there is Seventh Circuit authority saying that this should not be considered a forfeiture but require a waiver. And in this case, I think it's rather clear there was no waiver whatsoever by Ms. Pinnow, and given the way that it was raised by the court sua sponte without a clear opportunity to object, such as in the small case decided this morning, that we shouldn't find there was a reasonable opportunity to object for counsel. As the trial judges, former trial judges here are certainly aware, no one's particularly amused when counsel interrupts a judge in the middle of his order in a situation like this. And while there are times when a trial attorney has to do that, it's certainly not one where I think you would expect it under the circumstances of this case.
Well, they could do it by requesting to approach the bench, certainly. How do you address, in your original opening remarks, you noted that 85 potential jurors were summoned, 83 showed up. Mr. Weber made reference to those jurors not losing their status as members of the public or citizens by nature of their summons to appear as potential jurors. And then in your rebuttal, the first thing you indicated was there's no doubt that this was a closed courtroom. And just in case I lose you to other questionings, the second question I would have is, what is your response to Mr. Weber's observation that there is nothing in the record to show that your client was prejudiced?
On the first issue about whether or not the jurors could be considered members of the public, they certainly have some status there, but I think the right for a public trial means that persons that are uninvited and not part of the court process, the general public, the media, have the right to be there and to observe the proceedings, whatever they might be. On the second issue, as to prejudice, I think it's clear in cases involving public trial violations that you can't really show prejudice in terms of a different outcome for a public trial violation, as in this case, and that's precisely why it's considered to be structural error.
But Mr. Weber raised the hypothetical that, I mean, certainly as a former trial judge, it is not uncommon to observe family members and friends of the accused who are there to show their support and to assist in any way they can, you know, moral support and practical support. And it would not be beyond the realm. It seems very common sense that an accused would turn to their friends who are there to say, hey, do you know any of these people? Do you know anything about them? Because we know the juror questionnaires usually disclose only so much, and the more information counsel can have and both parties can have about the jurors, the better. Wouldn't it have been possible to interview some of those friends and family and find out if they could have been of assistance to the accused?
It certainly would have been possible, and I can assure you that's one of the first things that popped into my mind after reading the jury trial selection transcript in this case. There are persons with, frankly, very vague memories of the whole process. They couldn't recall the first day of the trial and much of anything. They weren't legally sophisticated, unlike Mr. Seaton's family in that case. So that's the practical problem. It's not certainly something we thought about.
Counsel, in preparation, as I'm sure everyone else did, reread Nadina, and I reread the concurrence. And the concurrence said, as I read it, let's not duck whether this is forfeiture or waiver issue. Let's decide it's forfeiture. But, said the concurrence, the defendant forfeits it as long as the defendant has an opportunity, had an opportunity to make the objection to the closure. And I thought, well, okay, if we're going to reach forfeiture and waiver in this case, we might consider that. We didn't reach it in the other case, so I wondered whether the defendant in this case had the opportunity to object when nobody knows whether it was open or closed. How could the defendant object if the judge says one thing, it's closed, but then says no, it was open? No witness can testify whether it was open or closed. So how can the defendant sitting there with a voir dire know whether it's open or closed and have the opportunity to object?
I think I agree with the court. Unless you give an explicit opportunity to object, like was done in the Small case, the defendant's and his counsel's attention, starting with the beginning of jury selection at least, is on the potential jurors, their answers to questions, their demeanor, other criteria you'd use for peremptory strikes or for seeking strikes for cause. So, correct, the attention is focused in an entirely different direction. So I think there needs to be a clear opportunity to object in order to say that there's a forfeiture or in fact, you know, strategic decision.
But I gather you want waiver, not forfeiture.
Correct.
But if the court takes forfeiture, then you want an opportunity.
Justice Bradley.
Thank you. The chief, in her question, said, well, who knows if it was open or closed? Well, doesn't that slip in as a bit of a problem for you? Have you sustained your burden of showing that, indeed, it was closed? I know that there was the testimony of the jury clerk that would indicate it was open.
Judicial orders are supposed to have meaning, and courts in other states have found and didn't even consider it an issue that a judicial order on the record established a closure. You could perhaps find something highly unusual outside a record, but I think in this case, the reason we have records is so that when you have a examination of a case a year or 2 years or 4 years after the case, you have some idea what happened. We have the judicial order. We have nothing indicating that it was violated in any way other than some very vague testimony. We don't know who or what type of people it was that were going in and out.
Well, she testified, as I recall, number one, there were victim rights people that were still present in the courtroom. Number two, that she was never told that it was going to be closed. Number three, that there were people that were coming in and out of the courtroom, but she could not identify them at the hearing.
Right. I think that's insufficient to overcome the presumption that would follow from a judicial order, the presumption that judicial orders are followed.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. That concludes the hearing on State v. Pino, and we will move to the hearing on 12-18-918, State v. Travis Seaton and Amelia Pizarro. Attorney Pizarro will represent Mr. Seaton, and that will be 18 minutes. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Amelia Pizarro, and I represent the appellant Travis Seaton. The right to a public trial is a structural constitutional right, one of the very few delineated rights that is fundamental to the fair administration of justice. In this case, Seaton's public trial right was violated in two different ways. First, when the court removed the public to make room for a large voir dire panel that we believe numbered in the 90 to 100 people range. And secondly, when officers stood guard outside the courtroom doors and prevented the public from returning to the courtroom. This case is really about the difference between forfeiture and waiver. And although in our case the state repeatedly used those terms interchangeably, they really are two very different and important concepts. Forfeiture is the loss of a right through an action. Waiver, on the other hand, is the intentional relinquishment of a known right. The question is whether an attorney who fails to object can forfeit a defendant's structural constitutional right. We believe the answer is no, that the only way to give up that type of right would be through waiver, which would require a colloquy with the defendant to make sure he understands the right and he knows what he's giving up. If, however, this court finds that forfeiture is possible, then it must examine Mr. Seaton's claim through ineffective assistance of counsel. There we believe that prejudice would be presumed, given the nature of the right. Either way, whether through forfeiture or whether through waiver, Seaton is entitled to a new trial if he can prove his factual allegations. Unlike Ms. Pino, Travis Seaton was never given that opportunity. We had a hearing, but it was limited to argument only. We had witnesses in the courtroom. We provided an affidavit. I provided a written and oral offer of proof. And I believe the court in its remark acknowledged the sufficiency of our basis for the claim. But still, the court denied our motion without giving us that opportunity. So I think that no matter how the court decides this issue, forfeiture or waiver, the presumption of prejudice, then Mr. Seaton ought to be given an opportunity to return to a different judge and have a hearing where he can have that opportunity to prove his allegations.
What allegations are we going to have him prove?
We had identified three jurors who would testify if called if they walked into an empty courtroom. We also have several members of Mr. Seaton's family who I believe would testify to being escorted out of the courtroom, that they witnessed the decedent's family also be escorted out of the courtroom, and that two family members, when they tried to return to the courtroom, were told by guards that they couldn't go back in. We also spoke to, I believe he was a security director, who said that in Fond du Lac County, it was common practice that in larger cases where it's a little bit more high profile, where there's a lot of attention, sometimes they'll even start the voir dire process in the basement before they bring up a group of people into the courtroom. So I think it was a common practice there.
How were you stopped from presenting this information?
Because the court ordered a hearing and specifically limited to argument. It prevented me from calling any witnesses. When we went to the hearing, I sort of argued that because we were in the courtroom, that we had met our burden for a post-conviction motion hearing, and we ought to be able to start the hearing by calling the witnesses at least present in the courtroom. And the court said no, and first heard the recusal motion, denied that, then heard argument on the public trial violation and denied that.
But you were stopped from presenting testimony?
Yes. We had witnesses present. We asked to call them. And the state, in fairness, said, you know, we're not ready for this. This court is, the judge specifically said when we scheduled this, it was limited to argument. And we said, okay, well, then let's schedule it, as I recall, for testimony. But the judge said no, because here's my recollection. And he sort of provided us with what he alleged happened, which we argued in our brief was contrary to the record, and that those weren't findings of fact, and they weren't, you know, he wasn't drawing conclusions based on testimony that he heard.
Doesn't the judge have discretion whether to take evidence?
I think to some extent he does, but here there's very specifically a test on what it takes to get a post-conviction motion hearing, and I believe we definitely met that test under Allen. And in that case, no, there is no discretion. We've met the requirements.
What's the requirements?
To demonstrate the 5 W's and 1 H, the who, what, where, why, when, and how. In using Allen as a guide in our reply brief in the circuit court, I've made a chart sort of identifying the people, what we anticipated them to testify to. We didn't just say, listen, the courtroom was closed. We said Roy Seaton was seated in the first row, and he was escorted out along with his wife and other people, and he sat in the lobby for 2 hours, and he saw the jurors file in, and he watched Travis's wife try to approach the door. So we very specifically said what we anticipated the testimony to be. And I think the court's rejection of our request for a hearing is sort of ignored completely the second violation, which happened outside of the courtroom, and unbeknownst, we believe, to any of the, you know, either the state or the defense or the judge, that these officers sort of blocked entry. And there could have been no way to object to that, because it wasn't discovered until we launched our investigation to find out whether or not the courtroom was empty or not, because I believe, and we argued from, you know, the post-conviction motion through the brief, that the transcript on its face is unclear, and that's why a hearing is necessary.
So these people were escorted out of the courtroom, and then the jury entered, the potential panel.
Yes.
Entered, and then no one else was ever allowed to come back in while the jury was there?
Yes.
Was there room? Is there anything in the record to show whether there was room in the courtroom?
We didn't get that far because we weren't allowed to have an evidentiary hearing. Now the state.
But is that what you told the judge you'd prove? Judge, I know there were two rows that were open and completely empty, and you didn't let the public fill them?
No, and I don't believe that's the standard. Because
I'm just wondering what the
landscape was. The state had made an argument on post-conviction, you know, 98 people, and if you fit 10 people per row, that's this many people, and there would have been room. And we said that's pure speculation. We haven't had a hearing, and that's not really the test anyway. The court has to make some accommodation for the public, and if that means half of the courtroom is for the public and half of the courtroom is for the jury, jury selection takes a lot longer, then so be it. So, I, you know, whether or not there was room, I think, doesn't really matter because you have to make room for the public. So I don't think you can say, well, you have a right to a public trial, but except we don't have enough room, so I'm afraid you're all just going to have to wait outside.
You don't have to make room for every single person if you've got several hundred people. I mean, the courts cannot do that. The courtrooms aren't big enough and don't have to be big enough except for the, you know, once in a whatever. But you can bring in, as you said, a third of the jurors, potential jurors, do the questioning. It takes longer because you have to repeat the general questions that you would ask. But you just didn't have the opportunity to say how many jurors there were, how many were needed, whether there would or would not have been empty spaces, whether there could have been communication outside the courtroom.
That's correct.
That's your complaint.
Right. That we were treated so very differently from Nancy Pino in a way that I don't think it makes objective sense. When Ms. Pino filed her post-conviction motion, she was automatically given an evidentiary hearing. She could call whatever witnesses she wanted. Meanwhile, when we filed our motion, we had this sort of limited hearing where we were prevented from calling witnesses. And I don't think there's a reason that the court made that distinction. And so I think, sort of no matter what here, we have to have that opportunity, request that opportunity to go back and sort of prove up the factual basis for our claim. Because it is our position that if we can prove the basis of our claim, either the first one, that the public was removed by the judge to make room for the panel, or the second one, that officers prevented the public from returning, then Seton is entitled to a new trial because it is a structural constitutional right.
You keep saying it's structural, constitutional, and what you do when you say that is when justices raise the hackles on the back of their neck. But that because when you say that, you're doing something that's automatic, and the whole point of the structural error cases is to indicate this is a limited group, a limited classification. And you can say that you don't have to classify something as structural in order to say that it's a kind of error that you can never prove prejudice. Therefore, it is given to you, to the defendant. For example, you may have a constitutional right to counsel. You may have an absolutely great trial, even if you don't have a counsel, and that you did it superbly well yourself, and that you are not prejudiced. But we don't say that, because we say you can't figure out whether there was prejudice, because you don't know what a trial lawyer would do if given the opportunity. So you assume prejudice. And there are other such instances where you assume prejudice because it's impossible to prove prejudice.
Yes, and I think with this particular right, the Supreme Court has been clear that it is structural. That, to me, there can be no question that it...
What's your citation?
It would be Press Enterprise, Waller, and Presley. And Press Enterprise was sort of the First Amendment case, right, where they said it was the press, and they said, we have a right, and they said, okay. And Waller was about the suppression hearing, and they said, well, does that right then extend to suppression hearings? And the court said, yes, it does. And then Presley said, in a per curiam, well, if there's a First Amendment right, so too shouldn't be there a Sixth Amendment right to be present for jury selection. And the court said, yeah, and we think it's clear from our precedent that that's the case.
Were there objections in those cases?
In Press Enterprise, yes, the press objected.
Do you think that makes any difference?
No, because this is such an important right, because the court has classified it as the soul of justice, as necessary to the fair administration of our system at large, I think it's the obligation not just of defense counsel, but of the court and of the state to preserve that right as well, because it goes to our whole system.
If it's such an important right, isn't it a good idea to let the judge correct it at the time? If you object, it gives the opportunity to correct it then and there.
And in Fien's case, that would be true possibly of the first one. But it wouldn't have been true of the second one, where something was happening outside of the courtroom. Perhaps, and we're not alleging, I don't think we can allege that, I'm not saying that the judge directed officers to stand up. There's nothing, that's not in the record at all. So it's just possible that these officers saying, oh, the judge wants everybody out, so we're going to do him a favor and keep everybody out. You know, the judge could have nothing to do with that. So that you can't object. And so the loss of the right shouldn't be dealt away with through forfeiture when there is no possible way an objection could have been made at that time. In Press Enterprise, there, the defense agreed, yeah, let's close this hearing. And the court said, no, you can't do that. It should have been open. And so I think because legally, even if defense counsel agrees to the closure, the court still has an independent obligation to conduct the four-part test. Is it an overriding interest? Is it narrowly tailored?
Counsel, I want to make sure I understand your answer to Justice Ziegler's question. When she asked you, well, if it's such an important right, isn't that something that you would object to at the time? And you said, well, there was no way of being able to know about it. Are you saying there was no way to know about the judge's order?
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
Or there was no opportunity to know about the guards outside the door.
I'm saying I don't believe there's no way for the court to know what was happening outside.
The court.
Outside of the courtroom door.
What about you, or what about your clients?
Well, my client wouldn't have known either because he was also inside the courtroom.
Right? Would your client have known about the judge's order that the jury room was to be made for the jury? I'm not talking necessarily about the posting of guards. I understand you're saying maybe even the judge didn't know about.
Okay, I'm sorry if I don't understand your question. You're asking me whether or not
your client would have known that the judge had made an order that anyone but jurors were to be excluded from the courtroom.
I guess anybody who's sitting in the courtroom would have known of the court's order.
So the answer to my question is yes.
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure, because your response to Justice Ziegler could have been construed as saying, gee, there was no way for your client to know about the order at all.
There are two issues here. One, the order, your client knew, everyone knew, right? The question might be, did the judge mean it, which is the other case. The second part of your argument is no one knew what the officers were doing. So, not your client, not the prosecutor. Therefore, there couldn't be forfeiture or waiver because there was no way of knowing that was closed and being turned away. So, your answer to Justice Ziegler dealt with that second issue, if I understood it correctly.
Yes, I apologize for my confusion, Justice Gableman.
But, I mean, I think that's the point. You know, one of the arguments often made here is that if we allow a party to just sit quietly by and not object, and then when something happens that the party doesn't like they get convicted or sentenced, then the party jumps up and says, hey, I object. And they're gaming the system, right? And one of the problems here is, so the judge says, clear the courtroom. We don't know if it's done or not done. That's the other case. But it says, clear the courtroom. So the defendant can game the system and just stay quietly by because something good might happen. Probably won't, but might. And then the system is gamed, and all of a sudden we have to have a new trial. 5 years later, all the evidence is gone. Bad scene. No finality. We sort of dealt with that issue of gaming the system by saying, hey,
Everybody knows this is the right of the defendant, and this was in Bangert. Defendant has a right to this kind of personal colloquy. The judge can make a mistake. The defendant doesn't object. But it's up to the prosecutor, too, to call attention to this and alert the judge. And the judge can do it, can make the correction right then and there, so the system isn't gamed. And I can't remember whose brief it was, and it may have been the amicus or one of your briefs that said, hey, that it's, and you just said it in oral argument, isn't it everybody's obligation to keep it open? Therefore, the prosecutor has the obligation to do it, the court has the obligation, and the defendant.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor, especially when you're talking about the public trial right, where the court has its own independent work to do in order to close the case, were to do the proper analysis. And here, there was no analysis done, let alone consideration of the press enterprise test. And I do think that it's the obligation of everybody to ensure the fair administration of justice. And I see my time is out.
I have a question. Is the recusal issue before us?
I'm sorry?
Is the recusal issue before us? Do you still object on that basis?
I do.
Okay, and then my other question for you is, did you make an offer of proof that the practice of closing on voir dire is common practice in Fond du Lac?
In our affidavit of the investigator, I'm sorry?
You made an affidavit of the, go ahead, investigator.
Yes, Mr. Kirkpatrick, our investigator, included in his affidavit the content of his interview with the security director who said that it was common practice in high-profile cases.
Ms. Bizarro, I wonder if you agree with Mr. Kaczynski's assertion that we are to presume that the judge's order is going to be followed.
Yes, I think that here the judge, it's our belief that what factually happened in this case, that the judge said, okay, this is what I'm going to do, and his bailiffs sort of enforced the order as he continued with the housekeeping matters.
Sure.
So I believe, yes, that the court made, I don't know if you can call it really an order here, because he said that's what I'm going to do, as opposed to I'm ordering you out. But, yes, we believe that the court's intentions were made clear and that they were enforced, and there should be a presumption to that.
All right. And do you agree that's what happened here?
Yes, and we think
then that... Then I wonder if we are to accept that presumption is true. What difference does it make if guards were posted out the door? We are to presume that a judge's orders are to be followed. Why is that a distinction with a difference?
I don't think it's a distinction so much that it's an additional violation. So if the court found that the judge's order, we presume the judge's order to be true, and the public was removed from the courtroom, then Seaton wins the remedy of a new trial. But I think we still have to prove that, because there has been no testimony about whether or not, in fact, the courtroom was actually empty or not. So I think we have to have that opportunity to do that. I don't know if I just answered your questions opposite.
I think you did.
Let me just ask you, in the Pinot case, the judge on the post-conviction hearing indicated it wasn't closed. That wasn't what he was doing. What did the judge here say after the fact?
Here after the fact, he said that it wasn't his intention to keep the public out entirely. It was his intention to make room for a large voir dire panel. And once they were seated, the public was free to return to the courtroom, and that he recalled seeing people in the courtroom. We believe that that is not accurate, that recollection is not accurate, based on our investigation.
So that the concept that he made, your concept is he made an order closing the courtroom, and then you wanted to prove that order was followed. He didn't let you prove that.
Yes. Okay.
He also stated, didn't he, with regard to your client, I know he did with regard to Pino, but I never locked this courtroom, I never secured this courtroom, and I never denied anyone access back into this courtroom at any time for any reason, unquote.
Yes, that's also what he said, which I think he demonstrated his belief that because He didn't lock the courtroom door. It doesn't matter that he removed the public to make room for a panel. And we don't believe that's true at all. But, of course, here, again, that second violation, there were, in fact, officers outside of the courtroom not letting people back in. So it was effectively a locked door.
Thanks. Sorry, any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Pizarro.
Thank you.
You have 4.5 minutes of rebuttal. Daniel J. O'Brien, Assistant Attorney General, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. O'Brien.
May it please the court. Mr. Weber gave this court a list of 5 points that he would ideally like to see in an opinion. To that list of 5, with his permission, I would like to add 3 more, either as points 1 through 3 or points 6 through 8, whichever you choose. The first point being that the public trial right, whether it's Sixth or First Amendment, is not absolute. Number 2, the public trial right must be invoked. It is not self-executing. It must be invoked either by the criminal defendant under the Sixth Amendment or by a member of the press or public under the First Amendment. And number 3, not every closure or every exclusion is the same. A rose is a rose is a rose, but a 5-minute closure of a trial where no one's testifying is not the same as a 7-day closure of a suppression hearing in Waller v. Georgia or of a complete contempt trial as in Oliver v. United States.
That goes to the concept of implication in Nadia?
It goes to the concept of implication? Is that what you asked? Yes.
I asked. If it's de minimis trivia, yeah, it doesn't implicate the Sixth.
And we crossed that bridge in Nadina, where I actually, in hindsight, agree that we're not really talking about a violation of the public trial right that is trivial. We're talking about no violation because the core values of the public trial right were, in fact, not harmed here. And those core values, again, ensure a fair trial, make sure witnesses come forward at trial, discourage perjury at trial, and to remind the prosecutor and the judge of their responsibilities to the accused and to the state to ensure that there's a fair trial before an impartial judge by an impartial jury. And in these 2 cases, that clearly happened. The Sixth Amendment right was not implicated in either Cipollino's case. No one claims that trial that occurred after voir dire was unfair, that the jury was not impartial, that the judge was partial, at least during the trial. Obviously, Mr. Seaton claims at the post-commission stage that there was partiality. But, again, and as to the point of the public trial right not being absolute, if I read the briefs of all the parties, including the amici here, everyone agrees the public trial is not right is not absolute. However, they actually take an absolutist position. If you read all these briefs jointly, especially the amici brief, where no one has to object, not even the press or public. The press or public doesn't have to be aware of the trial. The criminal defendant who raises the issue, in my case, 4 years later in a 97406 motion, automatically gets a new trial for an error that may or may not have done anything to affect the fairness of the trial. That's an absolutist position. That is not saying that the public trial right is not absolute right. That can, at times, as in Nadina, at times where the public trial right is implicated, nonetheless, the judge was correct to exclude members of the public from a substantial portion of the trial because the right is not absolute.
Is it? Yeah, it may not be absolute, but is there a difference in excluding some but allowing others? In Nadina, wasn't it only family members who were noisy in the balcony or family members who had interests? Other people were in there.
Well,
so
obviously
the public was there.
Yeah, it's a case-by-case analysis. Well, in this case, the public was as well. However, when you look at these core values, obviously it's not a black-and-white rule. And one thing that frustrates me about all these cases that really, in the end, do take an absolutist approach. And the state of Washington, I think, is the best example of what happens when you do that. You get a raft of reversals in cases where the public trial right may or may not have been violated just because no one objected and the judge didn't follow what they call the Bone Club procedure, but is essentially the Waller test.
Well, tell me when you can exclude the entire public, everybody. Tell me when you can do, when a judge, give me an example, when a judge can exclude everybody. Now, I can think of one where you'd show national security, state security. Maybe you have to exclude everybody. Maybe if you have a government informant who's on the stand and to reveal that this person's identity would really subject him to being killed or harmed. I mean, I can see, so when he testifies or she testifies, you can exclude everybody. When can you exclude everybody from the entire proceeding of voir dire? Just tell me when. When, I mean, it's not absolute that that it has to be open, but
you know,
we're
I suppose conceived theoretically, it would be most likely in the sensitive crime situation, where you have it's a case of child sexual assault, and you want to interview jurors about their experiences, if any, with
you
that
know,
feeling.
That's or, right. It's as to individual jurors, and we've said you can take them into the chambers because you've got harm to the individual juror, but that's not the entire voir dire.
Correct. I'm not sure that I can think of an example offhand. Maybe national security would be the closest where revealing
you
the identities of the jurors.
Mr. O'Brien, in the national security where they want to close it or they don't want to introduce evidence, they have to dismiss the case. That's what's been happening at the federal level.
I suppose they could. But, you know, again, I think you would have a greater problem there if you also closed the entire trial proceedings with the actual testimony.
I'm saying, when can you close the entire proceeding? Okay, and then I'll move it back to when can you close the entire voir dire? When?
So you're saying closing it to the public?
Close an entire voir dire to the public and the press. When can you do that? With and what is the kind of justification? Because I think I agree with you, it's not absolute. I think parts of it can be closed. I think particular witnesses can be closed. And I think particular people can be kept out of the courtroom, like sequestering witnesses. I mean, that's closing the courtroom to somebody. But I want to know, what justification can there be for closing the entire voir dire or the entire trial to the public? That's my problem. Because I agree with you about
that. It's an exceedingly rare situation. I guess that's all I can answer. I can't think, you know, again, unless there's a really powerful national security issue or if there's some risk, depending on the nature of the case, that any disclosing the identity of any of these potential jurors might harm them physically.
We have rules about disclosing identity of jurors, too, and taking pictures of jurors. So that's another factor. I'm telling you, close the entire proceeding. I'm pushing you on absolute position. I agree with you. It's not public. It's not absolute. But
it would be an exceedingly rare situation because now we are implicating the core values probably in that situation, and so you have a Sixth Amendment violation unless you can show that overriding interest, and that's going to be difficult to do. To say that we're going to close the entire voir dire, it's got to be a powerful overriding interest. I acknowledge that, and that's
but
what
the judge
says.
Did that here. The judge did that here. If you agree with his order, let's face it. Did the judge close the voir dire or didn't he to the public?
No, he did not.
Did not. Okay. So if we say that the judge didn't close the voir dire, we don't have to get to any of these other issues, right?
Well, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is.
Justice Bradley, he
may have improperly excluded a couple of people if you believe the affidavits, and they made an offer of proof, even though the judge did not take testimony, there wasn't a thorough offer of proof made. But that does not implicate the core values in this case because of what went on despite the absence of those people at the voir dire and the fact that the entire trial was open. And so, again, you know, it's not every exclusion of one person is automatically entitles you to trial. I mean, I think that has to be that no U.S. Supreme Court case has said that, and that can't be the rule. No one would ever object to a public trial violation. I mean, if I were instructing public defenders, I'd say, you know, if you see it, unless you see immediate harm to your client, don't object because we can save it for appellate review. We can even bring a 97406 years down the road and raise it. And that's what these cases like Vaughn and Purvis v. Crosby and, you know, are warning against. And you see it in the state of Washington, where they have adopted an absolutist approach, and they're getting all kinds of reversals, as that law review article by Judge Ellington pointed out.
Hey, isn't it good to reverse a conviction if the conviction should be reversed? Do we want to convict people when the conviction is invalid? I mean, don't we want to say, hey, if you deserve a new trial, you get a new trial? What is good about supporting a conviction when the court thinks that it violates rights?
If there is a showing that the outcome was unreliable or that there was harmful error that might have affected the outcome, sure, then you reverse. You don't reverse when that is manifestly not the case, which is what we have here.
Counselor, there was an attempt at an evidentiary hearing, and my understanding from opposing counsel's arguments and brief is that they tried to prove that, in fact, the proceedings were closed. Just assume the proceedings were closed before us. Your other arguments are simply that the core values that support a public trial were not impacted by this closed hearing, right? But my concern to you is, how can you be sure? How can you be sure? I mean, no one is claiming that there was an unfair trial here and that there wasn't evidence to support the verdict that was reached here. But is that really the ultimate test of giving a defendant a fair trial?
Well,
don't the procedures matter?
You have here, again, even assuming these two or three people weren't properly excluded.
Right.
You still have the basic tenets of an open voir dire. You have, first of all, it's fully transcribed, so you know exactly everything that each prospective juror said and every question that was asked. You also have, in my case, 90 of their fellow citizens sitting there taking in all this voir dire testimony.
So they substitute for the general public just because they were called for part of the jury pool?
It's not so much that they substitute. Was this open or not? It's not, was one person properly excluded? You know, in Brown v. Powell, we're talking about Seventh Circuit cases. The Seventh Circuit said the exclusion of one person for an entire jury trial did not implicate the core values of public trial right.
Right. I get that. I guess I'm interested in your assertion that the jury somehow satisfies the public trial right when there are so many of them as we have here, or does 30 jurors that are called satisfy it, or what is the number?
The complaint here is that the public was excluded, and that's an overgeneralization. The public was present.
Members were escorted from the courtroom, as was claimed in the offer of proof. Isn't that an issue here also? You don't think that's important?
It gets back to, Is this an improper closure of the? Is this tantamount to closing a trial? And what we have here again, we have assuming improper exclusion, assuming their allegations are correct that these people thought that they were excluded, whether in fact the judge excluded.
If you don't exclude them, they should have their hearing. I mean, if you're not going to agree that the family members were excluded, then it should get sent back, and they should have a hearing on that issue if that's really an issue before us.
Well, the problem I have with that, you know, again, this is a 97406 motion, and he has the burden of proof that his public trial right was violated.
How do you prove if you can't allow testimony?
Well, but again, if these people are excluded, is it enough to just say someone was excluded? I would, especially in the 1974-06 contest, my position, first of all, if that's the claim, and we're not claiming ineffective assistance, we're just claiming a family member was improperly excluded, then this should have been raised on direct review. And he's got to come up with a sufficient reason why it wasn't. But second of all, these people, if they had nothing to offer, and if they take the stand at the post-conviction hearing and said, well, if I had been included in the voir dire, having discussed it with counsel, having read what the jurors said and not knowing who the jurors were, I wouldn't have anything to offer. Why would you reverse in that situation? I mean, it doesn't, you know, again, the core values aren't implicated here. There's nothing to show that their presence, and even assuming, again, what's alleged in their affidavits and in their offer of proof is true, none of those people said, had I been in there, I would have assisted the defense in this way. There's also absent from this any allegation that they tried to contact defense counsel and say, we want in, and that bailiff won't let us in. And there's no allegation that at the post-conviction stage anyone talked to them and said, were you excluded?
Well, but, you know, I think that your argument about saying that perhaps the trial was not closed is really not getting to what concerns me, because if that were really what I was concerned about, I would order that, or try to get my colleagues to agree, that it goes back and give them a hearing on whether it was closed or not. You know,
but I'm not sure that that's the... I suppose you could have a hearing on the issue whether the judge only intended to remove people while the jurors, prospective jurors, were seated. I mean, you know, if that's what was happening, if that's all that happened, then I would say that that clearly fits the situation where the public trial rights values are not implicated.
People,
however,
We don't know, because we didn't have a full hearing on that.
Well, I mean, we do have a hearing.
That's what I kind of wanted you to start.
We do have
from
a hearing to the extent that they made their offer of proof, and Judge Nuss explained what he said happened and what thought he recalled happening.
I understand that. I guess what I'm trying to move you to is to, for the purposes of arguing to us, assume that they are right, that the trial was closed. Okay? Assume it was closed.
The voir dire.
Yeah, the voir dire. Then I want you to try to explain to me how they could prove that they were prejudiced, because I understand that that is your position, that they can't prove that any of the core values that underlie the public trial rights were violated here in the Sixth Amendment context. And I don't know how they would prove it, if you can help me with that.
Well, so are we talking now about prejudice in the Strickland analysis?
You know, Strickland is ineffective assistance of counsel. Okay.
Okay, so then if we're talking about just the straight up, was there a Sixth Amendment violation? Again, that gets back to my question, well, why wasn't this raised on direct review? But putting that aside, you can prove prejudice if one of these people says, you know, I knew one of those jurors. And they, having read what they answered, what they said during voir dire, they were lying. They should not have been in that jury. They knew the defendant, and they said they didn't know him. That's a case where you would have a clear showing of prejudice, potential prejudice, to the core value of a fair trial and impartial jury and the rest, and the potential perjury.
Because he got a fair trial, didn't he? They're not complaining that he didn't get a fair trial. You're not complaining that any witness didn't come forward. I mean, these are the core values. That's not their complaint. Their complaint is that there was a violation of a particular right, and you can't prove prejudice because you don't know what would have happened. Just like you can't prove prejudice if there's denial of counsel. You can't show a lawyer would have done a better job.
What I would suggest is the complete denial of counsel at trial is worlds apart from a closure of a part of a voir dire to a few people.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It seems to me your response should be forfeiture. right? Did they object?
Right, because if you object, then you ferret out all these issues, and we're not arguing about what might have happened and what did the judge mean.
That's right. So the state's position is, if the defendant didn't object when they knew that there would be closure, and they would know there was closure because the court said it was going to close, right? They didn't object. The end. Isn't that the basic position?
No, it's not the end.
Well, okay.
You still have a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel at your disposal, or plain error, or new trial on 75106 if you can prove a miscarriage of justice.
But then you have to show prejudice,
right,
which is extraordinarily difficult to do unless, in the rare case, somebody comes through and said, had I been allowed in, then I would have done such and such and assisted the defendant. But I was not allowed in. That would be a very rare case, right?
It would be, probably, as is, newly discovered evidence cases are rare, but we see them. A witness pops up 10 years after the fact. But, I lost my train of thought here, but I wanted to get to the point, and Justice Abrams,
Can I jump in for a minute? When the judge made his order or statement or whatever it is, there was no objection by defendant's counsel. It goes to trial. There's a direct appeal in that trial. Now, was the issue of a public trial ever raised in that direct appeal?
No, there was a post-conviction evidentiary hearing and a direct appeal, and it was never raised.
Okay, so two times. So wouldn't that allegedly involve ineffective assistance of a post-conviction counsel?
I think it is. I think it would be.
If there's something here.
If there's something there.
Yeah. And you talked about 97406. This trial was in 2008, wasn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Okay. And the motion hearing that some members of the court suggest was deficient, that was in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in order for this defendant to prevail, I think this court would have to rule that this is a structural error. It doesn't, the fact that there was no complaint about it anywhere in the process until 4 years later makes no difference. Forfeiture is not part of this at all.
That's correct.
A sufficient reason. No, none of it. It is just, this was a structural error. It can be raised any time by a defendant.
Or it completely ignores the burden placed on the defendant under 974-0606 to prove his case at the collateral phase and, as this court said in Wahlberg, to prove it by clear and convincing evidence. We don't have that here. And if I see my red lights on, I just want to make one quick point. Justice Abramson referred to the Bangert case, and that's a very apropos example because that was a case I argued where I asked this court in Bangor to overturn what was up to then an automatic reversal rule for effective guilty pleas that was resulting in dozens and dozens of reversals. And Bangor took the right approach and allows for proof of actual prejudice and after-the-fact post-conviction inquiry and avoided a lot of unnecessary reversals as a result. And I asked this court to take a similar approach.
Yeah. Right. Now we just have fights about Bangor.
A la Taylor.
It just substitutes the fights, Mr. Ryan. I can't give you the numbers, but we understand that.
Right.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Thank you. Ms. Bizarro, what do you have in response to this huge time delay? And that you allow this game playing by the defendant.
Thank you, Chief. First, as to the timing, let me say that the post-conviction motion in 974-06, obviously there's no deadline for filing that. But in this particular case, we filed it within the year and 3 months afforded to federal habeas relief. Now, the direct appeal took, I think, nearly three of those 4 years in order to conclude. And so that's not something that Travis Seaton should be held accountable for. His direct appeal attorney, his post-conviction attorney, was the same as his trial attorney. And so that this issue could not have been raised on post-conviction, trial counsel could not say that he was ineffective for not raising this objection on the direct appeal. So certainly there's sufficient reason that we raised it now. That was something that was never challenged below, and I think the state has conceded it. But to say that there's been this big 4-year delay is, I think, to sort of misinterpret the record, because we're here timely for federal habeas review. While the public trial right is not absolute, that doesn't somehow make it not a structural right. I think the Presley decision is very clear. The right to a public trial extends to voir dire. There is a presumption that voir dire be open. When it is wholesalely, sort of the public is wholesale excluded from that process, there has been a violation of that structural right. And the remedy is a new trial. Presley didn't require that the lone courtroom observer who was kicked out there somehow have an impact on how jury selection would have gone. He didn't have to prove, well, I would have been helpful to the defense. And that's not something that should have to be proved here. He also doesn't have to prove, Mr. Seaton doesn't have to prove, that the trial was unfair in some way. And on direct appeal, he made that argument. It's structural because it can't be measured, because it's so valuable to the fair administration of justice. And I don't think there would be a raft of reversals if this court granted Mr. Seaton relief in this case. If this court says, as the Supreme Court has said, that voir dire is to be open to the public and the removal of the public during that process is a structural constitutional right that entitles him to a new trial, then the only cases that will be reversed are the ones when that occurs. And so it won't suddenly be this, I don't know, huge free fall of reversals. If the court is to send a message, perhaps the message is that this right is as valuable as the Supreme Court has told us that it is, and that if you're going to close the proceedings, that you have to follow the 4-part Press Enterprise test, and you have to explain yourself, and that there is a presumption of openness. As to the other authorities that the government mentioned, I don't believe that the Washington Law Review article has any bearing on the proceedings here. First of all, if the court would like to hear more from me on that, I'm happy to submit something in writing. It wasn't something that I received until Friday of Labor Day weekend. But that's very specifically about Washington State and how Washington State is dealing with their cases. And I don't think it has anything to do with the case here. I also think the same thing of the decision that we got today. That was about a person who was allegedly intimidating witnesses. You know, that's not a group of people being removed during voir dire. And I think ultimately what the state is arguing is that kicking out the public during voir dire, it never implicates the Sixth Amendment. Again, that's contrary to controlling precedent. You don't have to show harmlessness because it is a structural constitutional right. This wasn't the removal of 2 to 3 people. We contend this was the removal not only of the defendant's family and friends, but also of the decedent's family and friends. We think it was the removal of dozens of people, not 2 or 3. And again, we weren't given that opportunity to develop that so that this court is in a position to say, yes, it was definitively closed, or no, it wasn't definitively closed.
Well, if we gave you the opportunity to have that hearing, it would have to be that you didn't forfeit.
Right. Well, I think either way. If the court says it's forfeiture, so let's look at it through ineffective assistance of counsel, then I think we still get to have the hearing, because we get to call defense counsel to testify, and we also get to call the others to show, yes, it was, the public was removed. And still, the issue of what happened outside of the courtroom would matter.
Still have trouble showing prejudice.
But
you
I
got
think,
a fair trial.
Because I think prejudice is presumed, because it is.
That's
ultimately the answer. And I think our brief delves into that.
Did the defendant's post-conviction counsel know that people couldn't get back into the courtroom because of the officers?
In our brief, we have a footnote in there. We say we don't think that he knew, but we don't know, and we would need to figure that out at the hearing. We sort of presume that he didn't know it. But we haven't had an opportunity to develop that.
He'd be a witness.
He would be a witness.
I'm not just asking for a new trial, or if you don't get a new trial, a hearing. Aren't you also asking for a different judge?
No, Your Honor. We believe that the that there was an appearance of bias here, if not actual bias, in how the judge treated us on post-conviction from the beginning of our investigation through the hearing. The court denied an open records request on the interest of justice, which it's not permitted to do. It decided the issue in a letter before we had even filed a motion, and then it prevented us from calling witnesses when it treated another defendant similarly situated very differently. And, you know, the state kept saying, well, it's the defense burden, it's the defense burden. But as Your Honor pointed out, I don't know how we can meet that burden if we're not allowed to have a hearing. If there are more and more questions, I thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, all the counsel here, in a very interesting open trial case involving the Sixth Amendment, but with the First Amendment thrown in for flavor as well as law. And so I want to thank Mr. Kaczynski and Mr. Weber and Ms. Bizarro and Mr. O'Brien for being able to stand on your feet that long and sit that long in the afternoon, as well as good briefs and good oral argument. Yes,
I just
ma'am.
Had a brief question. I had submitted for the first time ever an electronic brief, and I was wondering if after the court issues a decision, if the members would mind if I followed up to get feedback on how you thought of that. As a matter of courtesy, I submitted the brief on CD with links to the cases and all these other things.
I'll check with the court afterwards and see what they do, but I used paper briefs, and I'm looking up and down the aisle in their paper briefs. But the briefs are online, so whether you submit them, counsel, electronically or not, they are electronically available. This court has not yet, the court system has not yet gone to electronic filing. And we have now in force in the trial courts opportunity to adopt electronic filing. And for your information, it's not going over like gangbusters. So, one of the considerations which hasn't come to the court yet is to require electronic filing, and other states have found that unless you require it, it doesn't get done. So the court, although you filed it electronically, the court has it electronically, and you're requested to file it.
Sent a CD for everybody and has links, so it's, I don't know.
Mr. Webber, do you want to add to this discussion?
We're just...
That's right. Exactly.
I was just curious if anyone had...
And you can check with the... You'll check with the members of the Court of Appeals who are attending that seminar that is being put on, because the Court of Appeals requested that we ask lawyers to file electronically their briefs so that all members of the court can read on their iPads or on other electronic devices that are supplied by the court system. So that should be very interesting, and if we can, we'll try and send you something, okay? But I'm aware of that seminar, and Dave Haas, unfortunately, has died, but that seminar will go on as scheduled. Thank you.
Thank you.